From WYPR, this is The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin. Happy to have you with me via the radio airwaves this hour as we embark on a different sort of radio journey together, a philosophical odyssey, a conversation about the fundamental nature of existence, truth, and the meaning of life. It's not often that I get to make an introduction like that, but it does suit the occasion here as I welcome to the program philosopher and musician Jonathan Badger. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Badger, I should say, teaches at St. John's College in Annapolis. He is a guitarist, a composer, a video artist. He's just released an album. It's titled Verse, and it's out on the Cuneiform Records label. And we're going to be hearing some of that music here and there as our hour progresses. Jonathan also has just published a book, a philosophical treatise published by Routledge Press. It's titled Sophocles and the Politics of Tragedy, Cities and Transcendence. We're going to be taking that book as our point of departure for this hour's conversation, a conversation about the nature of tragedy, what it really means, why we basically can't avoid it, and what we might actually learn from it if we stare it in the eye. But first, Jonathan Badger, a few words, if you would, about yourself, about how and why you have come to dedicate yourself to this perhaps esoteric discipline of philosophy.
It's certainly not a profitable enterprise, but it's beautiful. And if we ask any question, there's always a question behind it. And if you were to keep tracking those questions backwards, you finally work your way back to fundamental questions or some sort of bedrock. And it's at that level that the formal study of philosophical matters becomes very useful and interesting. There is something behind life, and we want to get at it, and philosophy is one of the ways of making that voyage.
You say in your book, I'm not sure if it's a quote that originates with you or someone else, philosophy is preparation for death. Is that your ultimate motive as a philosophy student, someone who pursues this discipline?
That quote comes from Plato. That's in the dialogue, the Phaedo. Socrates, as he's awaiting execution, tells his friends and students that philosophy is the practice of dying and being dead. There are many opinions about what he means by that, but it is of particular significance for tragedy, at least in the way I'm approaching it. And the idea is that the aspiration for fixity and the beautiful necessarily leads us out of this world, we might say. The living world is a world where nothing is stable, nothing stands still for very long. It's difficult to get any sense of permanence or a fixed point by which one can adjudicate the deepest questions. But Socrates presents this idea of a realm beyond life where there are fixed and still silent forms. And those are available to a certain kind of contemplation. But, says Socrates, they are also available to us in death. So that the act of contemplation, of philosophical activity, gives us access to something that is only otherwise available in the next life, as it were. And thus, philosophy is gaining some kind of access to death while we still yet walk the earth.
Jonathan, you mentioned the term tragedy. We're going to be getting into a rather intensive conversation during this hour about how human beings deal with tragedy. And we're going to be talking about a particular traditional definition of the word tragedy. I wonder if you might explain what the word tragic means and doesn't mean in a specifically philosophical context.
Well, there's the ordinary usage of the term. People speak of some sort of terrible event as being tragic. And people seem to mean by that that it's very sad. And this is not right. Strictly speaking, tragedy does not mean melancholy or awful, but rather it's the inevitable conflict between necessary goods, that is, competing principles to guide action, come into conflict. It's the collision of these irreconcilable aims that constitutes the tragic. And I think that we can see through poets like Sophocles that our nature is tragic. That is, we aspire to things that lead us into calamity. And tragedy is, the tragic form is a way of showing us what it might mean to cope with such a predicament.
So we are equipped now with this definition of tragedy, Jonathan Badger, and I suppose we're ready to embark on our conversation about these great works of Sophocles, the Ajax, the Antigone, the Philoctetes. And as we get ready to do this, I wonder if we first might just take a minute and clear our minds with the help of some of your music. As I mentioned, you've just released a new album. It's called Verse. And so I wonder if you might have a track in mind that you'd like for us to play here as we get ready to embark.
Well, you might play the opening track, the first one, which is St. Lucy's Day.
Music from the album Verse by Jonathan Badger. He's our guest this hour on The Signal. In addition to being a composer and performer and recording artist, Jonathan teaches many different subjects at St. John's College. He's also the author of Sophocles and the Politics of Tragedy. And Jonathan, I wonder if you now might lay out the essentials of the narrative arc as it unfurls in Sophocles' tragedy, The Ajax. You have this great hero of old, Ajax, who ends up being humiliated in a way by one of the gods, made to seem sort of like a crazy person, and ostracized by this civilization, this society that he doesn't really have that high of an estimation for in the first place.
Ajax sees himself as superior to the people who are around him and, in fact, is superior. He is guided by principles of excellence and beauty, and he's disgraced. He ends up taking his own life, and the central drama of the play is what to do with his corpse. And we see his brother and family advocating for the heroic status of Ajax, and we see the political community seeking to further disgrace the memory of Ajax by having his body be food for animals. And Odysseus bridges the two sides and helps us see the necessity of both of these perspectives. And the play ends with Ajax's body being ceremoniously disposed of with the blessing of the community.
Now, Jonathan, let me rewind back to this moment when Ajax, well, he falls on his sword. He commits suicide because he's just unable to confront a certain civilizational future. Talk about the world that he comes from and the world that he just can't bring himself, I guess, somehow to accept.
Yeah. Sophocles, like Homer, is showing us a transitional period from an old order to a new order, from one kind of civilization to something new. And the old order is the world of heroes, great men, excellence, and honor. The new order is one of political expedience, craft, guile, and doing the necessary thing for the sake of safety and survival. And Ajax finds this new order to be repellent.
Specifically, he's at odds with these two political rulers, Menelaus and Agamemnon. These two are sort of foils for each other, but they want, I guess, the same thing. Talk about these two characters.
Menelaus is recognizable to us, perhaps, as what we think of as a tyrant. He rules with intimidation and force to make sure that the community is safe. That's his aim, is the preservation of the Greeks at Troy. His brother, Agamemnon, is also interested in mere bodily safety, but his approach is something we might recognize as democratic. He sees the strength of the community being in the summation of its members, so that everyone is equal and the collective moves forward with a kind of consensus. So Agamemnon and Menelaus are at odds with this old order. They each represent a new version of how political life can be organized, but they are different from each other. The fact that they're brothers is striking. I mean, we see through this presentation of Sophocles that tyranny and democracy somehow are related.
Then, of course, as you mentioned, we have the intercession of Odysseus in this story. Talk about his role as a bridge between Ajax on one side and these political rulers on the other side, these two irreconcilable impulses, you know, this hero of old, this man who aspires to beauty, and then this world of political expedience. You describe Odysseus as a man with a tragic consciousness.
Odysseus sees both sides of the problem. He understands what it is that Ajax aspires to. He understands the greatness in a heroic figure. But he also recognizes the expediency that Menelaus and Agamemnon pursue. He sees the reality of the threats to the community and the need to act in a unified way. So he gets it on both sides. But these two extremes can't understand Odysseus.
And your answer, in a sense, analytically, is that this notion of friendship can provide a bridge where there is none.
It is through friendship that Odysseus bridges this impasse. He is a friend to Agamemnon. Agamemnon calls him his friend and acquiesces to Odysseus's urgings on the basis of that friendship, despite not agreeing with Odysseus. And he is a friend to Ajax and Ajax's family, even though they will not acknowledge him as a friend. Odysseus is simply a friend in spirit to them. He recognizes the necessity of their point of view and seeks to protect it.
You're tuned to The Signal on WYPR. Our guest on the program this hour, philosopher and musician Jonathan Badger. We're going to pick up our conversation in just a few minutes, but first, an excerpt from Jonathan Badger's album, Verse. You're tuned to The Signal on WYPR. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Aaron Hinken. We continue our conversation now with philosopher Jonathan Badger, author of the book Sophocles and the Politics of Tragedy, Cities and Transcendence. Jonathan, in our last segment, we got into this notion of tragedy as this inevitable locking of antlers between these two fundamental human impulses, the aspiration to the beautiful, the aspiration to heroism versus the need for bodily security. We took a look at how this collision happens in Sophocles' tragedy, The Ajax, and I want to move on now to his work, The Antigone. And let me have you explain first the narrative arc, the story that we're dealing with here. Who is Antigone? What and who is she up against? And what happens when these forces collide?
Antigone is the daughter of Oedipus, who famously killed his father and slept with his mother. So Antigone is both the sister and the daughter of Oedipus. There are other children of Oedipus, Eteocles and Polynices and Ismene. Ismene is Antigone's sister. Polynices and Eteocles, the two brothers, come into conflict. They slay each other in mortal combat as Polynices is attempting to seize the throne of Thebes, their home city. As a result of both Eteocles and Polynices perishing, the uncle, Creon, ascends to the regency and decrees that Polynices shall be left to be eaten on the battlefield outside the city walls. This is something that Creon does to show the city what life is apart from the city. That is, we are meat for birds and dogs. Antigone thinks that this is awful, that despite the fact that her brother is a traitor to the city, that he should be given due burial rites. So the play is a drama that lets us see these two sides. The side of Antigone, where there's an aspiration to a spiritual side of life, which is looking to that which is eternal, laws that transcend any political order on the one hand, and on the other hand, Creon, who advocates the stability of the city as the highest good. And if that stability is maintained, then all of the other things are possible. But the city is the highest thing for Creon. So the play is a sort of a working out of those two aspirations.
So let's go ahead and unpack that from here, Jonathan. Talk a little bit more about this character, Creon, and his notion of the ship of state. This poetic term, the ship of state, that this idiom has its origins in this play, does it not?
Yes, it's an idea that we see in several of Sophocles' plays, that image is used. But it's the idea is that the city is like a ship, that if it's maintained and correctly piloted, protects the people who are in the ship. And only if that ship is secure can there be any hope of any other kind of human fulfillment. So keeping the ship afloat and in good stead is Creon's highest aim.
And that ship is kept afloat in the face of a term that I learned through reading your book, parallax, this notion of alternation, these forces that will cause necessarily tragic results. But people like Creon, who believe religiously in this notion of the state, they think all of these impermanences of fate can be avoided.
There is this idea of parallax, and that's going to be something that's unacceptable to all of these characters. And basically the idea is that things change, that if you're a friend of one person, that in the future that person may also be your enemy, and vice versa. Or if one thing seems good right now, tomorrow it may seem bad. So the world is full of these kinds of alternating menaces, in a sense. You can't trust anything. And the dangers posed by this are something that people like Creon believe can be mitigated by means of politics, through having sturdy, good institutions and strong, clear laws. We can protect ourselves from the verities of human existence.
And then, of course, the other option is to do what Ajax did, which is to fall on your sword and be frozen as a hero in Hades, or to have this fascination as Antigone does in this play we're talking about right now with death, with Hades, with the underworld.
Antigone looks to the beautiful among the gods below, the place of the dead, where her parents are, where her family is now, And the laws that come from this source are laws that do not or have nothing to do with political laws. And this is our salvation from the wretched impermanence of our condition.
Tell me about how the conflict between Antigone and Creon is mitigated in this tragedy.
It is not mitigated. That's what makes this play resonate as something profoundly tragic, although I would still argue that the other plays that we will talk about are also tragic. This play lets us see the calamity. Creon never learns the other side of the problem, and Antigone never learns the righteousness of Creon's perspective. And so they both stick to their guns, and as a result, they are both destroyed.
Jonathan Badger, philosopher and musician. He's our guest this hour on The Signal. We're talking about the notion of tragedy, the classical definition of the term, as it manifests itself in the works of Sophocles, and thinking about what these ancient dramas maybe have to tell us about the way we live our lives today. Jonathan, we're going to take a musical break here for a moment and listen to a little bit more music from your new album titled Verse. Music from the album Verse, out on Cuneiform Records, by Jonathan Badger, composer, philosopher, author, and our guest this hour on The Signal. And Jonathan, I find myself wondering, as I listen to your music, if you have a defined, you know, quote-unquote philosophy as a composer, or if music is like, you know, something outside those analytical parameters for you.
That's a good question. I don't think of it as a break. And I don't want to load it up too much with the pretensions of it being another kind of philosophy. But I would say this, that which pulls me towards music has the same flavor as that which pulls me towards theoretical inquiry, philosophy, and political philosophy. There's some kind of unity that one wishes to achieve through thinking and action, and for me that manifest musically. There's some kind of spirit, if you will, behind music, which speaks from that underlying unity. And I think that philosophical aspirations also are a response to some kind of coherence to being. So the two activities I for me at least, seem deeply connected, and that's the way I would try to articulate that.
I'm pleased to be able to share this music on the program. We'll hear some more of it down the road a bit, but I do want to turn back to your book now, Jonathan, Sophocles and the Politics of Tragedy. As we get ready to delve into this curious work by Sophocles, a tragedy titled The Philoctetes. Philoctetes is this man who's exiled to an island where he lives alone for many, many years until he gets paid a visit by some maybe not so welcome guests. Talk about who this man is, what happened to him, why he ended up on this island, and then how the story unfolds from there.
Philoctetes is a peer and friend of Ajax and Achilles. He's one of those heroic warriors who sailed to Troy out of obligation to Menelaus and Agamemnon. On the way there, at a stop at an island, the Isle of Lemnos, Philoctetes was bitten by a snake and had a horrid wound inflicted on his foot. And this made him a cripple. It made him, he no longer could serve as a warrior. And he was abandoned there by his men.
It made him a pariah as well, because the effluence of this wound was so disgusting and odious.
Yes. His foot stank and oozed and bled, and he would go into a kind of seizure where he would just moan and scream. And so he was unbearable to the people around him. And the Greeks abandoned him on this island, marooned him alone as they went on to Troy.
So there he is on this island, and then one day a ship pulls up, and on that ship is our sort of recurrent character, Odysseus, and a young warrior named Neoptolemus. Tell me about these two and what they are there to do.
Yes, well, another thing that we have to remember about Philoctetes is that he is in possession of a wonderful weapon. It's a bow, the bow of Heracles, and it has been foretold that that bow will be necessary for taking Troy. There's some controversy. Some interpreters of the prophecy think that Philoctetes himself is needed for this taking of Troy. Others think it's only the bow. At any rate,
that's what they're there for.
That's what they're there for. Yeah. Odysseus and Neoptolemus have come to retrieve the bow, and their first attempt to do so is to lure Philoctetes himself back with the bow. And another thing that's important to note here is that Neoptolemus is the son of Achilles, and his name literally means new warrior. He is a kind of heir to the heroic tradition.
So this exile, this pariah, Philoctetes, is going to have a certain affinity for this young man, Neoptolemus.
Yes, he's the son of someone that Philoctetes judges to be truly great.
But this young man is being sort of mentored in the ways of, maybe you would say, diplomacy, maybe you would say manipulation, maybe you would say exploitation, by Odysseus.
Yes, the Greeks have judged, and Odysseus is certainly behind this, that they can use Neoptolemus to persuade Philoctetes to come back. And so, in a very real way, Neoptolemus is being manipulated into bringing his status as the son of the great hero for the ends of the community.
So bring us back to this notion of tragedy, classical tragedy. What are the two fundamental human impulses colliding? And how does this play, if at all, manage to resolve itself?
I think we can see in this drama that the Greeks at Troy are moved by bodily safety and expedience. They're not moving at the behest of anything like beauty and honor, but they want to win this war, and they need this weapon to do it. And so by hook or by crook, they will get the weapon back from this man that they have treated so badly, with no concern for any kind of justice or dignity or honor on Philoctetes' behalf. On the other hand, we have the heroes. We have Philoctetes himself, who speaks very explicitly about the principles that guide him, honor and beauty and friendship and greatness, excellence. And so there's the opposition. Odysseus, again, is present in this. And it may seem that Odysseus is just a partisan of expedience. But I think if we look carefully, we can see that Odysseus is manipulating the situation so that there is resolution, so that Philoctetes can be shown a way back into the city to bring his virtues into this new order. So Odysseus wants to have it both ways, and this is what I'm calling the tragic perspective. He's not given to one or the other. He's seeing these extremes and navigating a precarious middle course.
Insights from the ancient tragedies of Sophocles, this hour on The Signal. Jonathan Badger is our guest, and when our program continues, we'll carry these insights up through the Middle Ages, the early modern project, John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, and onward to present-day political theory. I should say when he's not writing and teaching philosophy, Badger is composing and performing and recording music. A track here from his new album, Verse, out on Cuneiform Records as we head into a short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin. We've been talking this hour with philosopher Jonathan Badger, author of Sophocles and the Politics of Tragedy, Cities and Transcendence. We've been delving into the meaning of tragedy as is classically defined, this notion that we, as humans, have got these two fundamental impulses that are inherently in us and at odds with each other. On the one side, beauty, the heroic, transcendence. On the other, order and bodily security. We've looked at how this tragic condition has been poeticized in the ancient works of Sophocles, and now, Jonathan Badger, we begin to spin the clock forward first to the Middle Ages. What happens when this philosophical hot potato gets passed on to the hands of the likes of Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, and Giles of Rome?
Well, what I try to do is say that insofar as we are moved by the insights of ancient tragedy, it should be true that these insights would be applicable to general human concerns. So I look at some basic ideas of modern political theory and try to apply the insights of ancient tragedy to the problems of modern theory. So what we see with some of these medieval political theorists, notably Thomas, Giles, and Augustine, is a political order guided by a commitment to the beautiful, the just, the good, the righteous, the holy, the construction of a city of God. And if I put it that way, we can see that it aligns with Antigone, an extreme view that seeks to adjudicate human matters in divine terms.
So from that sort of political organization, we move to the 1600s, and we sort of take a right turn with Sir Francis Bacon and this sort of proto-sci-fi novel called The New Atlantis. Talk about this story about these people who get lost at sea and they find this island that's ruled by these sort of scientist kings.
Yeah. So Bacon's vision is for something that we now would call modern science. And this scientific project will make life better, much better. And so Bacon envisions not only the advance of science, but actually a scientifically ordered political community. And you're exactly right. The New Atlantis gives us an image of this utopian community on an island that's hidden from the rest of the world. And it's ruled by a league of scientists who have established a religion and a way of life that is ordained by science as making people healthy and happy and prosperous.
And then from Bacon, we move to a contemporary of his, Thomas Hobbes, and his work Leviathan. And this is a sort of a radically secular project that seems to say that the well-being of people's spiritual souls is almost irrelevant. It's all about the stability of the governing body.
Right. So Hobbes is sort of a generation after Bacon, and he's fulfilling something Bacon calls for but never manages to achieve, namely political science, a scientific approach to politics. And Hobbes in the Leviathan gives us the elements of political power, what it's made of, how it should be divided and channeled. And we see a sovereign authority that wields a mighty sword that keeps the subjects in awe. And apart from this powerful sovereign is much suffering. So if we were to challenge the authority of this sovereign, we're risking civil war. And civil war is hell on earth, the worst possible thing. So Hobbes is really advocating for a very robust and powerful, centralized monarchy.
He's, in a sense, a reincarnation of this ancient tragic character Creon from the Antigone.
I want to make the claim that there's something we might call Hobbes Creonic in that sense. Yeah. So as opposed to Thomas Aquinas and Augustine and the medieval vision of a city of God, we have here a Creonic vision of a materially secure, very powerful city that is ruled from a central point.
And then, Jonathan Badger, we zoom in on what you refer to as the originary liberalism of John Locke. Let me ask you to talk about the Lockean notion of this coexisting I and me, and how his political theory tries to get a lasso around both of these notions of identity.
Well, that's a big thing. I don't know that I can do it quickly, but the first thing I would want to say is that insofar as we are persuaded that the medieval visionaries were somehow Antigonean, and the early modern theorists like Bacon and Hobbes were Creonic, if we're persuaded by that, then I want to carve out a place for what the Odyssean character would be in this historical drama. And here I posit Locke and liberalism as filling that middle ground. That is, liberalism, Lockean liberalism, is very well aware of material need and the insights of the political science of Hobbes. But it is also aware of whatever it is that stands behind the aspiration to transcendence as embodied by the medieval theorists. Liberalism is a kind of reconciliation of this. It's imperfect. No one is satisfied by it. There's perpetual tension and conflict and frustration, but it acknowledges the limits of what we can aspire to, such that if we were to fully aspire to either side of the antinomy, we would destroy ourselves. We would end up in calamity. And that is the danger of the city of God, as well as the sort of the brutal scientific state, it destroys our fundamental humanity.
So you end up with this political theory that is imperfect, frustrating, never satisfying, but the closest thing to a viable political theory that we can get as human beings, considering that we have these differing dual identities of I and me.
Yeah, that's why I call liberalism a tragic politics. And tragic, again, doesn't mean that it's a sad politics. It means it's a politics that recognizes the limits of pursuing our basic aspirations to the fullest extent. That is, we preserve both aspects of our strivings, material security as well as spiritual transcendence. How can those two things be held together? Well, liberalism aspires to do that. Now, where does this perspective come from? And here I try to draw the connection between Lockean psychology and what we see in Odysseus in Sophocles' plays. The idea is that Odysseus is able to see both sides of the problem because of an expanded sense of self. He doesn't see himself simply as Odysseus. Rather, he sees in this idea of self all men. In Locke, in the essay concerning human understanding, we see Locke's notion of psychology. There is an I that is overlooking our entire lives, and there's what he calls the me, which is the situated self. So the me is something that's moving on the basis of material aspirations, whereas the I surveys our entire life at once. And it's the connection of the I and the me that gives Locke the perspective that he articulates politically in the second treatise.
We're going to philosophically fast forward from Locke to the 20th and 21st century to look at how more modern-day political theories are grappling with this universal, inescapable human condition, the tragic condition, as explained by philosopher and musician Jonathan Badger, our guest this hour on the program. But first, a moment of meditation, a mental reset, if you will, a little bit of music here from Jonathan Badger's album, Verse. Music from composer, performer, recording artist, philosophy teacher, and author Jonathan Badger here on The Signal. And Jonathan, take us now into the present through this ancient lens that we've been developing of the tragic consciousness. What of fascism, Soviet communism, the theocratic police state of Iran? Are we making philosophical progress, or are we kind of spinning our wheels at this point?
Well, it depends on who the we is, but I would argue that what we can see in the 20th century is in fascism and in Soviet communism, the desire to establish a monolithic, powerful authority over all aspects of life that, in a sense, crushes the idiosyncrasies of the individual would be something that we could see in fascism. Soviet communism, at least in principle, was set up to be a regime of perfect justice, a communist utopia. And both of these orderings necessitated the squelching of the individual. And they were calamitous. One we destroyed in a war. The other one collapsed under its own contradictions. And once again, liberalism emerged as the middle ground that seems to be consistent with natural human presence in the world.
So on one end of this political spectrum, you've got these projects like fascism, like Soviet communism. And then on the far other end of this spectrum, you've got what's going on in Iran, this theocratic state that's much more like the medieval state that we talked about in our last segment of our program.
Right. We never fully escape these aspirations towards the extremes. This seems to be built in. And in different times and places, they manifest. They blossom. So I think we can see it internationally at present. This sort of talk may be controversial, and there surely are other ways to put it. But I would put out there the following, that in a regime like Iran, we can see the aspiration to a city of God and holiness, which, if we look at it that way, is there's something beautiful about that. On the other hand, we can look at a regime like China and see the commitment to stability, security at all cost. In both cases, the individual is repressed. Liberalism, again, offers a middle ground between the two. It does not banish an aspiration to the beautiful, nor is it naive with respect to the needs of the body.
Is it fair to say, Jonathan, though, that within our own, you know, sort of American political project, we're sort of naturally gravitating to these two polarities of the American left and right? What if we looked at those, at our own political parties, through this same lens?
Yeah, and this might even be more controversial, but I would make the case that we can see this antinomy playing out within our own body politic, insofar as, in one sense, we wish for a just community. We want the world to be fair and good. On the other hand, we value the liberty of the individual and the right to live our lives as we see fit, to practice the religion we prefer, to secure our own household. So the idea of bodily security and an aspiration to great ideals like justice is something with us. And as a result, we see ourselves splitting into different political factions depending on how these ideals line up in our own thinking.
Before we wrap up, Jonathan Badger, let me just give you an opportunity to share any sort of parting thoughts about, you know, where you're left intellectually, philosophically, at the end of writing a book like this, as you think about, you know, a decade, a century down the road. Is this something that we're going to navigate more successfully in the future, or just continue to sort of chase our tail philosophically?
I think that the nature of the problem results in a persistent instability, and that is a good thing. Stability is the cultivation of something that is still and motionless, and that is death. So a thriving, living community will vibrate. It'll be pulling in one way and then the other. So that's not bad news. One thing that I would want to say in terms of the value of studying ancient tragedy, because, I mean, we think of that as something that any educated person would know a little bit about. We never let go of ancient drama, but we're not sure why, I think. I think and this kind of study helps us see why it is of use to us. That is, a liberally educated person might see that opposite points of view both have value, in which case we won't have our heels dug in into one position or the other. We can see that there is a valuable insight in people who hold radically different views from our own. And I think that's something that tragedy offers us.
Jonathan Badger, thank you so much for spending the hour with us. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Jonathan Badger is the author of Sophocles and the Politics of Tragedy, Cities and Transcendence, published by Routledge Press. He's also just released a new album. It's titled Verse, and it's out on Cuneiform Records. That's going to wrap things up for this week's episode of The Signal. You can find on-demand audio and podcasts of the program at wypr.org/programs/signal. That's also where you can reach us with any thoughts or questions you might have about the show. The Signal is an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore. For 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, I'm Aaron Henkin. Thanks for listening.